This material is subject to copyright. No unauthorized recording, editing, copying, or distribution is permitted without the consent of the Economic Research Council. All rights reserved. For more information, visit www.ercouncil.org. Audio lectures by the Economic Research Council.
Thank you for the invitation, which I very much appreciate. I have spoken before you, or at least some of you before, but I think it's quite a long time ago, and I have no idea what it was about. So what I'm going to do in about half an hour, which is quite difficult, is to sort of provide a summary, or an overview, perhaps that will be a better word, of what I say, what my book is about, and at least some of its points. And I'll roughly divide it into two parts. So if I do well, it'll be about 15 minutes each, and then there'll be time for questions. The first part is my view of what happened, because it's about the global financial crisis, or crises, or the financial crisis, in fact, not global is the wrong word, that has occurred since 2007 in both sides of the Atlantic. And the second part will discuss some of the policy implications, some of the implications in terms of policy. What I didn't do in my book, except in passing, is discuss what might happen next. And the reason for that was partly because I was quite sure I didn't know, and partly because I thought, and I'm sure I was right, that that would date sensationally quickly. And I wanted to write a book that people would still be interested in at least a year after it'd been written, if not 5 or 10 years. So what I tried to provide is my overview, which now, 7 years after the worst of the crisis, has a modicum of completeness, although, of course, we're not through all this by any means, and then discuss some of the policy lessons. So that's what I'll try and do. But before I do so, I think I should say a little bit about why I think this is an important topic, which might not be controversial, but I think nonetheless is significant. I think there are two reasons, at least, probably more, why it's an important topic. The first is that these crises were unexpected. I don't say they were unexpected by everybody, but I think in the scale, I'll come to that in a moment, of the financial crisis itself and the subsequent effects on economies, pretty well everybody, maybe there are a few exceptions, failed to appreciate what could happen. And I think the point I would make about that is it's not, in my view, or at least it's the way I put it in the book, a failure of forecasting. Actually, there are very deep reasons, it seems to me, why the timing and scale of crises of this magnitude are unforecastable, partly because if they were really easy to forecast, people would have taken action which would have prevented them, either public or private, because there are such huge losses involved. And it's partly because the economic system is simply too complicated and these events are too rare to be easily forecastable. So I think the problem was not that it wasn't forecast, and I don't think my answer is not that it's forecastable, because I don't think it is. I'll come to that. They are. I don't think they are. Perhaps I'll come to that again in a moment. I think the problem, so far as this aspect of it was concerned, is not that people couldn't forecast it, but that the conventional wisdom, at least, was that a crisis of this magnitude was inconceivable. That seems to me a much more important point than that it was unforecastable. That is to say, this is something that couldn't happen. The conventional wisdom of policymakers and most academic economists was that a disruption of this scale in the financial system, followed by such a deep recession and such a long period of economic malaise. No country has regained previous levels, trend levels of output, and so forth. I'll come to that in just a second. But that it was essentially an inconceivable event. And remember, this was an extraordinarily large crisis. In some ways, I think what actually happened to the core financial system was unprecedented in scale. It really just fell to pieces. And that didn't happen in the 30s, interestingly. And the second reason why I think it's very important is the one that I've already hinted at, which is that the subsequent economic experience has been, to put it mildly, extraordinarily disappointing. So if you look at the size, to take just one indicator, I won't go into many others, the size of the major Western economies, so the Eurozone, the UK as a whole, treat to the Eurozone as a whole, the UK and the US, and look at these economies today, or the most recent quarter, and compare them with what you might have expected if really quite long-term trends had continued. In the case of the US and UK, I've looked at trends both from 1950 to 2007 and also from 1980 to 2007. They come up with essentially the same results. The Eurozone is more difficult to go back so far because putting all together the GDPs is quite a complicated task, and I didn't do that. But the same result applies even if you go back to the mid-90s for them. And essentially, all these economies are now, GDP-wise, in terms of GDP, one-sixth, roughly, between 15 and 20% smaller than people would have expected if previous trends had continued. And since unemployment has not exploded upwards anywhere, in fact, generally has remained, with a few exceptions in southern Europe, quite low, the implication, of course, has also been that productivity is immensely much lower than people would have expected on previous trends. In the UK, the decline in productivity relative to long-term trends, again, is as big as the decline in GDP, and that's why employment performance has been so good. So this has been quite a shock, to put it very, very bluntly. I'm not saying that a wise person couldn't have guessed this, but we are immensely much poorer than the general view was, and including my view, of where we were likely to be by now. And all the evidence we have from even recent performance is this is not going to be recouped. And indeed, there is no country, none, that I am aware of, in which productivity growth has returned to the pre-crisis trend. This is the only country which has, of the major countries, I haven't looked at all the minor ones, which has had a few quarters in which growth has returned to the pre-crisis trend, but since unemployment has been collapsing and productivity growth has not risen, that's clearly not as sustainable. So we can assume that that growth will go back to rather a low level very soon, possibly close to zero, actually, if productivity doesn't start improving. And in the US, where the performance has been relatively good, productivity growth has never been more than half what it was before, on average, over a long period before the crisis, or close to a half. So not only are we far lower in levels, we're far lower in trends. And that means, and I'm not suggesting that's just because of the crisis, that means this has a very, very long-term results. This has very, very long-term results. Essentially, we don't know what they are, but probably forever. And I have some computations of that. So this is why it's important. That leads me to the question of why it happened. And I'm going to have to short-circuit, maybe we'll come back to it, a rather complicated discussion. But my argument in essence is that two things came together and interacted in quite complicated ways to bring about this extraordinary series of shocks in the world economy, and particularly here I'm focusing on the US and UK, and then I'll just touch on the Eurozone, which has special problems and features, before I turn to what might be done. So the first thing that happened is some profound shifts in the world economy. That's my shift story. And the most important by far, I think, and it works in a number of different directions, with globalization. which had large effects on income distribution in our societies, shifting income towards capital away from labour and towards and help assisting the shift of income towards particularly very high earning income of very high earners. So that was one shift. The second effect associated with globalization, very, very important one, was initially a period, quite a long period, about 15 years, when capital flowed net from rich countries to poor countries, which is the direction you would expect it to have gone in a globalizing era. Not just gross, I mean, there was lots of FDI, but net. So a lot of countries ran larger current account deficits. In the mid-1990s, this phenomenon was associated with a long series, two in particular, of huge financial crises. The tequila crisis was the less important. In the mid-90s, the bigger was the Asian financial crisis. And after that, all the emerging countries, but more or less without exception, and above all the East Asian ones, proceeded to run their policies in a way designed to run large current account surpluses and very large accumulations of foreign currency reserves. They pursued, to put it very crudely, mercantilist policies. And I regard that as largely, though not exclusively, designed to protect themselves from financial opening, the consequences of financial opening, and partly as a return to what the East Asians had previously learned was the safest form of development strategy, the Bretton Woods II strategy, it's sometimes called, which is a deliberate policy following Germany and Japan in the 50s and 60s of building up export surplus in industry behind it. And, of course, China pursued this policy in both respects, for both reasons. And the result was a simply staggering accumulation of foreign currency reserves, which went from about $1 trillion at the time of the Asian crisis to $12 trillion today. This is a simply staggering accumulation of official wealth. I argue that the consequences of these two things I've talked about, and there are more, had a very obvious effect on global real interest rates, which essentially collapsed at about between 1997 and 1999. I use as a measure the index-linked gilt in the UK, but you could use others. It's just very pure, and we are the only country that provides this measure over a long period. The shift is massive. Basically, the real interest rate halved in 2 years. From 4% to 2%. This is a massive shift in a core price in the world economy. And I argue in the book that, not coincidentally, it was precisely at the time that this real interest rate halved and the emerging countries started becoming massive capital exporters that house prices started rising in all the countries where house price booms became significant. And those were, of course, associated with very rapid expansions in credit aggregates, related to house purchases, mortgages, and so forth in those countries. So the house price explosions basically occurred in those countries where credit was highly elastic. And that leads me to the second part of my argument of what happened, is that these very large shifts in the global economy that I've described, the shift towards capital and high incomes, which in impact effect was to raise desired savings in our economies, combined with this massive shift towards desired savings in the developing world, which became net exporters of savings instead of net importers on a very large scale, was demand contracting for the rest of the world. And the way that demand contraction, that effect was dealt with de facto, by inflation targeting central banks, and particularly the ones presiding over credit elastic economies like the US, which is much the most important, but also ours and Spain indirectly, Spain by the ECB, is they pursued relatively expansionary monetary policies from then on, particularly after the stock market bubble burst, which were designed, but not deliberately, but effectively accommodated or encouraged extremely rapid credit accumulations in these economies, those were largely associated with the financing of mortgage booms, which allowed a very large part of the population to borrow more than they could have ever done in any other circumstances. That's particularly dramatic in the US. And associated with that huge additional borrowing to finance assets was also a trickle over, very large expansion in spending, which was balanced these economies. So the economies were essentially balanced at close to full employment by getting the household sector, and it was exclusively the household sector, to spend vastly more than its income for quite a long run of years. And that occurred here, but it occurred particularly dramatically in the US, also in Spain and Ireland, and a lot of Central and Eastern European countries. And all those countries subsequently went into crisis. Now, none of that would have been possible, and the debt accumulations that went with it, if we hadn't previously and at the same time liberalized our entire financial system. It couldn't have happened otherwise. And the liberalization of the financial system continued before the crisis. It was accelerated in the late 90s in the US, continued de facto and de jure in the early 2000s with light touch regulation here and all the rest of it. And essentially, the financial sector, concomitant of what I've talked about as the debt in the rest of the economy, predominantly the household sector, was an immense expansion in the balance sheet of the financial sector, simply staggering expansion in the balance sheet of the financial sector. I'll come to that in a moment. And an enormous, increase in the leverage of the financial sector. In the case of British banking, which I know best from the Independent Commission on Banking work, the leverage in the British banking sector as a whole rose over just a period of 5 years from 2003 to 2008, doubled. The leverage doubled from roughly between 15 and 20 to 1 but to between 30 and 40 to 1. So essentially, by the time the crisis hit, our banks had equity equal to about 2% of their balance sheets, 2 to 3% of their balance sheets. And the situation in the US and the rest of Northern Europe was very, very similar. Just to give you some idea of the balance sheet explosion in the UK case, for most of our history, the aggregate balance sheet of our banking sector has been about 50% of GDP and has not changed very much from that. At the beginning of the last decade, I think it was about one time GDP. I can't remember the exact figure. At the time the crisis hit, it was five times GDP. Now, a lot of that was not directly related to UK lending. It was related to the acquisition of foreign assets, most notably through the takeover by RBS of ABN AMRO. But in the process of this enormous increase in the balance sheet of our banking sector, we acquired, unfortunately, a huge amount of dud assets, particularly in the US. I have a lengthy discussion of what happened in the financial sector, and obviously it was particularly important in the US, and the involvement of the rest of the economy, of the rest other economies in the US boom through the originate and distribute model. And my final comment on what happened is that the right way, I think, to view the Eurozone is as much the same process as I described, except it's also driven by an internal dynamic to the Eurozone, which is that you can think of it as one economy. The most important economy in the Eurozone adopted de facto, wasn't quite as deliberate, a Chinese-style policy, namely an export-led growth policy, Germany, obviously, and the Netherlands to a lesser degree, which consisted from the early 2000s onwards of essentially two things: rapid tightening of fiscal policy after the unification boom, and essentially real wage suppression, shifting income from real wages to profits, which was given the very weak investment. Again, corporate investment has been very weak everywhere since 2000, creating huge surplus savings. But at the same time, this squeeze on wages combined with the ability to incorporate Central and Eastern Europe into the German productive system, made them incredibly competitive vis-a-vis everybody else. So they had a very competitive export sector and very, very weak domestic demand in the most important Eurozone economy. Now, the ECB, interestingly, has had exactly the same dilemma as the Fed, which is this emergence of this huge surplus in Germany. It went from about balanced to surplus of 7% of GDP in 6 or 7 years, meant that the underlying demand in the Eurozone was extremely weak. As an inflation-targeting central bank, it had to respond to that in just the way the Fed had to when its currency was driven up by the interventions of all the other countries I've talked about. Exactly the same dilemma. And the ECB, of course, pursued also a remarkably relaxed monetary policy in the 2000s up to the crisis. And again, like as is always the case with a loose monetary policy, it works because somewhere there's a credit boom. And in this case, the most important credit boom by far was in Spain. It was it was a mini one in Italy and a mini one in France, but the biggest one was in Spain. And a number of the other smaller countries, which were just as big for them, but not as big relative to the Eurozone total. But the effect was that there were several economies, Greece, Spain, and Portugal, that ran current account deficits of 10% of GDP a year throughout the years leading up to the crisis. Ireland was smaller, but because they had rather a competitive external sector, but also the credit boom was colossal, and there was a not inconsiderable one, not on this scale, also in Italy and to a small extent France too. So the ECB responded to what was going on in Germany in this way. Obviously, there's an interesting question of why credit was so inelastic in Germany, and that's, I think, actually a genuinely fascinating question, but the important point for this analysis is it was a fact. It was. And then, of course, the crisis hit. The lending to the cross-border lending to all the countries I've listed stopped. There was a sudden stop, effectively. These countries were immediately thrown into crisis. The private sectors collapsed because they could no longer borrow. The house price bubbles all collapsed. A similar story in Central and Eastern Europe. And the Eurozone, to a greater or lesser extent, has been struggling with this crisis ever since. But since it doesn't have floating exchange rates, and since the central bank is controlled to a significant extent by the creditor country rather than by the debtor countries, the process of adjustment is much, much slower. We can discuss that, if you like, in more detail, but the two factors that the central bank is not under control of the debtor countries, as it is in the case of the US and UK, and the fact that the exchange rate is fixed, unlike, say, in the Asian crisis, when that hit, exchange rates fell by 50%, in Korea, for example, and by 80% in the case of Indonesia. But, of course, in the southern European countries, that adjustment has not been permitted. So you've got these massive depressions instead because external finance has driven out. They've all been pushed into surplus, and the process of doing that has been massive contractions in demand and massive wage suppression and incredibly high unemployment. In the case of Greece, I think I can just throw this in because I think it's so extraordinary, and I think very few people are aware of this figures. Real domestic demand in Greece between 2000, they made many mistakes, and they were the one country with serious fiscal excess. But in the case of Greece, real domestic demand between 2007 and 2013 declined by 40%, 40. So that is, I think, a depression on anybody's calculations. This is much bigger than what happened to anybody that I'm aware of in the Great Depression. So that's what's happened, in my view. The interaction, I argue, is the core of macroeconomic forces of great power with a liberalized, highly deregulated financial sector, which was permitted to expand its balance sheets in any and every way without any regard to how much loss-absorbing capacity it had. And when the crisis hit, we discovered, to our surprise, I was one, so I feel, but unfortunately I was in good company, including all the regulators, that essentially our financial sector, and this is true of the West as the whole, had next to no loss-absorbing capacity, the core institutions. So that's why they all ended up by being rescued by the state, and it's why one of the first things that happened, which is fascinating in the crisis, is the interbank market disappeared. And the interbank market disappeared because all the banks worked out that they couldn't lend to any other bank because they were all insolvent, or they thought they were. So you could argue that this was really a process in which HSBC decided that all its counterparties were bust and it would start lending to the central banks instead, which is what roughly happened. HSBC was the most important creditor bank as far as I can see. Okay. Now, this immense breakdown leads, obviously, to some very profound questions, which is, what do you do about this? And I'll divide my analysis, if I might, into two parts, again, the sort of short to medium term and the longer term. In the short to medium term, you have, in essence, two problems. We've had those problems since 2007-08. The first problem is that as a result of the process of disintegration that I've described, demand collapsed. And we were suddenly moved into a world of rapidly rising unemployment, chronic demand deficiency, and fears of deflation. This process turned out, actually, I won't have time to go into this move into deflation or ultra-low inflation turned out to be much slower than one might have thought. But anyway, that was the fear in the fourth quarter of 2008 and early 2009 that we were moving into depression territory. And it is worth noting that in the last quarter of 2008, in the first quarter of 2009, world output, world trade, world manufacturing output were all falling at the rate of the Great Depression. So that was why everybody was so frightened. There are very good papers on that. You can have a look at that. But so the immediate response was a simply monstrous, massive rescue effort. And the rescue effort consisted of, and it should never be forgotten, the complete socialization of the liabilities of the entire financial sector. The complete socialization of the liabilities of the entire financial sector, which occurred in October 2008, and I describe exactly when that happened and how. They were all made part of the state. The recapitalization of much of the financial sector to a greater or lesser extent. So that was the financial rescue. Then there were various divergences. But we know roughly what was done to recapitalize. The US was quickest. We were much slower, and the Europeans have really taken an immensely long time to deal with that side of the problem. But they sort of largely stabilized the financial sector, except in the peripheral countries where it's still not fully recovered. And that's one of the reasons why their recessions have been so incredibly deep. Even in Spain, for example, real demand declined by 20%. And that was partly because the housing bubbles collapsed and the housing investment collapsed, but it's also because the banking sector was not rescued. The second thing that was done, and I don't think there was any serious possibility of doing anything else, was a transformation of monetary policy towards ultra-ease. This occurred very, very quickly, though more slowly in Europe. But basically everybody moved from whatever conventional rates were to close to zero rates. In the Euro, ECB was to 1% within a few months. And we've been there ever since. So we've had this ultra-easy monetary policy supported by quantitative easing and other unconventional policies ever since. I won't go through the details of that, all discussed in the book, and we can come back to that. And the third thing that was done is largely accommodating fiscal policy. There was an immense move into fiscal deficit. In this country, for instance, we ended up with fiscal deficits of 11% of GDP. In the US, it was even bigger. But that was not, I would like to stress, I discussed that in great detail, because of deliberate policy, which was a relatively small element in that. It simply occurred because there was a collapse in GDP, a collapse in revenue relative to GDP, because profits collapsed, particularly financial sector profits collapsed. So the revenue base collapsed. Nominal spending was largely given by previous decisions, as they always are. You know, there are plans for nominal spending. And, of course, you had a large recession. So the nominal spending exploded because of the normal things that happen to countries with any sort of welfare state. You have unemployment benefits. You have additional housing benefits and all that stuff. But so as a result of this, huge fiscal deficits opened up. In one or two countries, mostly the US actually, there was a not inconsiderable amount of discretionary fiscal action. In the US, it was cumulatively 6% of GDP roughly, so about 2% a year over the period. But that's very small next to the increase of fiscal deficits. So it's really important to understand that the huge fiscal deficits that emerged were the consequence of the crisis against the given preceding fiscal policy decisions rather than the result of discretionary action. Then, of course, by 2009-10, people started to get very worried about the crisis in Southern Europe. This created what I think of myself as the "we are all going to be Greece" hysteria, and that led to a shift in the Toronto summit in early 2010 towards a general agreement that fiscal policy should tighten, and that basically happened everywhere. So we've been on a tightening fiscal policy since 2010. The degrees have changed, and we can debate whether that's been significant. So that was what was done in the short run. Unfortunately, in my view, the immediate effect of that combination of policies was not as effective in supporting demand as I would have liked. So the recessions were much deeper and more prolonged than I think they needed to be. And the subsequent recovery weaker, and that affects investment, so that affects supply permanently, and it also affects employment permanently. But this misguided austerity, as I see it, was far the most severe in the Eurozone, and it has been a very significant factor, in my view, in the very prolonged weakness of the Eurozone. To just give you some indication of that, today, in 2014, second quarter, to be precise, real demand in the Eurozone is still 4% less than it was in the first quarter of 2008. So it is vastly shrunken. In our case, it's 2% above that. After all the revisions in the US, it's 6% above it. So we are above the starting point in real demand terms, and the Eurozone is well below it. So the first big question then is short-term demand policy designed to stabilize the economy, prevent going to great depression. The second set of issues, and I'll have to leave, not be able to go into this in detail, is what you do to prevent this sort of thing happening again. A pretty obvious question. Now, the way I think about this sort of thing is a bit, you know, how should we think about this? There are developments in economies that are rather like the equivalent, it's not perhaps not the perfect parallel, but rather like living on an earthquake fault, except we create it because the economy is our own creation. It's not out there in the world. And if you live on an earthquake fault, sooner or later an earthquake will happen. You don't know when. It's very, very hard to predict, and you don't know precisely where. But sooner or later, the pressures grow, and if the pressures grow, they are likely to be released in some massive earthquake. So there are essentially two things you have to do: reduce the likelihood that you live on an earthquake fault, and create buildings, particularly financial sectors, that can survive earthquakes. So that's sort of the way I think about what you want to do to manage these sorts of problems. Now, the most important reason, in my view, that we have been living on an earthquake fault is the global macroeconomic forces that have been at work, the combination of huge global imbalances, sometimes called the savings glut, it's an aspect of it, and with massive shifts in the distribution of income in our societies towards capital and naturally high-saving people. So the rich and companies have been earning far more than they spend consistently. They want to acquire valuable real assets, but the economies, our economy is not generating these valuable real assets. at all. They're just not generating them. And the emerging countries are generating valuable real assets, but they don't want to import capital. They've demonstrated that clearly. Net, they don't want to import capital. They think that's too risky. So the way we've resolved this, de facto, is in one of two ways. Either the excess savings of corporates, that's the excess of retained earnings over capex, is invested in indirectly via the banking system into housing bubbles, or it's invested in government deficit. Those are the only two sectors left. So if you want to fix this at a macro level, you have to fix the crude imbalances. And that can only be done, essentially, in one of two ways. You reverse the net capital flow, so they go from rich countries like ours, not high saving, actually, relatively low saving, but rich countries like ours that don't seem to be able to use our savings well at home, to poor countries. And to do that, I argue, you need a fundamental transformation of the global monetary system to make emerging countries think that they can become net importers of capital safely. And that was, of course, exactly the challenge that in a different context Keynes faced in Bretton Woods, and we're back with the Bretton Woods debate, essentially. That is the point. The alternative policies in dealing with these imbalances are, from a global point of view, is that our governments run deficits forever. That creates problems, pretty obviously, in absorbing these excess savings. Unless you start thinking of ultra-unorthodox policies like the ones that Adair Turner's been talking about recently, namely just monetizes the deficits, and that obviously creates huge risks of its own. And the alternative possibility is to run policy or change fiscal and other policies in such a way as to encourage corporate investment and discourage corporate retained earnings. And that involves quite radical changes in fiscal policy, largely in the opposite directions to the ones we've actually been pursuing. So there's a big global balancing question here after this huge losses. So that's the reducing the likelihood of living on earthquakes, because my view is that the main indicator that you're living on an earthquake zone is that you live in an economy in which debt is rising faster than gross debt is rising much faster than GDP over a very, very long period. Sooner or later, that is likely, I think, to create a credit crisis. And then the second question, which obviously is closely related to this, is how you make, as it were, our financial buildings able to survive earthquakes. And that was the main thing that I was concerned with in the Independent Commission on Banking. And without going into the most radical proposals, there are a number of different possibilities, but I think the most important one, and I discuss that at length in one chapter of my book, there are many others, I won't go into macroprudential policy and all this sort of stuff, but the core of it is to insist that banks are much more heavily capitalized than before. And if banks are much more heavily capitalized, they have much more loss-absorbing capacity, which means shifting capital around the economy in a very interesting way, which we can discuss. But it means that when a crisis hits, it'll be less plausible that they're going to collapse. If it's less plausible they're going to collapse, we shouldn't have the panic element. We should still have the adjustment, develop debt trends like the ones we had before couldn't continue forever, nor could asset prices continue on up forever, house prices continue on up forever, as we saw in all our economies. But it wouldn't create this severe panic associated with the fear that basically large chunks of our financial sector insolvent. Of course, if you insisted on much more capital in our banks, it's the probability is that credit magnitudes will grow much more slowly, and that raises some very interesting questions about how you run monetary policy in that environment, which we can discuss also. But one of my suggestions is to make the central bank a more central element in the creation of money again, rather than relying entirely on the money multiplier. So what I've tried to do is indicate three essential things. One, this is a very important crisis with very significant long-term implications, which we're living with and will probably live with forever. It wasn't forecast, which worries me less than the fact that most people that I know of in the policy-making circles and economics thought it was inconceivable. Second, In my view, it was the result of the interaction of global macroeconomic forces, just a few of which I've been able to trace out in these remarks, and with the consequences of the deregulation and liberalization of the financial system, which simply went mad in this context, as I've tried to describe. So we ended up with incredible financial fragility, and therefore when the asset prices started to go down again, and people began to realize that there were significant bad debts in the financial sector as a result, this led directly and indirectly to a wave of massive panic, which destabilized the entire financial system. So that's the second thing. And the third thing I have said is, in the short run, the aim has been, rightly, to keep from a total collapse, to restore demand, and get back to growth, and that's been relatively successful in the US and UK, largely, I think, because of monetary policy, and relatively unsuccessful in the Eurozone, as I've indicated, because of its huge internal problems. In the long run, to avoid things like this happening again, we need to rebalance the world economy, because we are essentially unable to use the savings that our private sector is generating, at least at the moment. And that requires really large changes in the global monetary and financial systems, monetary system above all, and to create a financial sector which is able to survive shocks of this scale without the enormous collapse we have seen. I know I've gone on a little bit longer than I'd hoped, but that's a brief overview of my argument. I hope it will not be sufficient to persuade you that you now don't need to read the book, because I would find that very, very disappointing. I should say I will get no more money from this book, so my interest is purely, as it were, altruistic. I would like people to read it, even if they end up disagreeing. So I'm very happy to take questions.